Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We begin our show and have for months with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified before the impeachment hearing in 2019. As I remind my audience constantly, if you want to know what the voice of a patriot sounds like, listen to the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. I have in front of me an article from The Hill. I just want to share a paragraph before we get our first guest, the beloved Scott Braddock. Here's what Representative Adam Schiff, one of the House Democrats who led the impeachment inquiry into President Trump, on Wednesday did when he thanked Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman for participating in the proceedings after Vindman announced that he was retiring from the Army. In other words, he was pushed out. That's my words. Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, wrote in a letter to Vindman that his testimony during the inquiry stuck with him because of the military officer's stated belief that in the U.S., right matters. Schiff also took aim at President Trump's bullying and retaliation, writing that Vindman should not have to choose between your oath of office and your career. And let me just give you the essence of the letter. Right matters. Right does not matter to Donald Trump, but it matters to you. It matters to this country and to its people. It will always matter. And with those words, you have left an indelible mark on our nation's conscience and history. For if right does not matter in our country, if truth does not matter, then we are truly lost. So Vindman's attorney sort of talked about what was happening to him. It was clearly retaliation. It was just an obnoxious, toxic environment. And with that, the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it is Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, and we air on KPFT in Houston, Texas, so obviously we feel very near and dear to Houston on so many levels. And I wake up in the middle of the night now, Scott, so terrified by what we see, not only because what we're hearing from the Houston hospitals, but what we're sort of watching with this governor who keeps sort of changing his position by the hour. And then the Houston mayor telling the Republican Party in Texas, you can't have that convention in Houston. It's too dangerous. And they're taking him to court.
Well, they may be taking him to court. I'm going to speculate that they don't really have time to mount a legal challenge on this, Arnie. And when the Republican Party of Texas chairman yesterday responded to the quick action from the mayor, Sylvester Turner, who I know you have some history with, and remember Sylvester Turner, I think when he was in the Texas legislature years ago, the mayor, and let me just explain his decision. I will say that the Republican Party chairman said that they were ready to go ahead with their convention, and he included the possibility of it being online. Earlier in the week, Sunday night, I was up for hours with the state Republican Executive Committee until about 11:30 on Sunday night. They did adopt a backup plan to hold the convention virtually online in case it couldn't be held in person. So I think they're not going to take him to court. They'll probably just back down from that and go ahead and do their deal online. There are a lot of good reasons for the chairman to want it to be online. So it may be that the mayor did him a favor, even though the Republicans can't say that.
I was thinking the same thing.
And he probably
got cover. They got cover.
That's right. And look, I mean, the political reality, of course, is that you have a Democratic mayor who has stepped in and stopped the Republican Party of Texas from having their convention. when, you know, you could have imagined by next week, the president might have been weighing in on Twitter. And of course, he may still do that and say that the Republicans in Texas are weak for not having their convention in person the way he's having his rallies in person. But it was quite a day yesterday, and that was on, we're taping on Thursday, it was on Wednesday, that in the morning, the mayor, Sylvester Turner, told city council during their regular meeting that he had suddenly ordered the city's legal department to review the contract for the Republican Party of Texas to hold their convention at the George R. Brown Convention Center in Houston, which is controlled by the city. The mayor had not previously asked for such review, Arnie, and so some Republicans said, well, what's this about? The mayor said that he got a letter from the Houston Health Authority at the Houston Health Department warning that this would be a, quote, super spreader event. We're talking about at least 3,000 people or so, maybe as many as 6,000 people gathering indoors. Of course, this is thousands of people who are the least likely to wear a mask, right? Because these are people who are protesting the fact that the governor is ordering people in Texas to wear masks, and we'll get to that in just a second. It was a clear and present danger, quote unquote, according to the Houston Health Authority. So the mayor went ahead and ordered this review of the legal contract. That was around 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday. And by 3 o'clock, the convention arm of the city, it's a nonprofit called Houston First, which is the landlord for the convention center, they sent a letter to the Republican Party saying that the contract for the convention was being terminated, that they were not going to be allowed to have this event starting next week in Houston. And probably, as I say, it gave the Republicans the out that they were looking for. Earlier in the day, it had been announced by the Republican Party that Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Patrick were not going to speak in person at the convention. They were going to speak via video.
Oh, no!
The plan from the Republican Party was they were going to speak via video, even though a spokesman for the little gov, Dan Patrick, had said that he still planned to be there in person anyway. So there was some mixed messages coming from the lieutenant governor. The lieutenant governor on Fox News Channel on Wednesday night told news anchors that it was a power grab by the mayor of Houston, and the Republican Party chairman said that he was very disappointed because the party had done a lot of the things that the mayor and city leadership had asked, which was to set up various precautions, including temperature checks for people to go in and limiting access to the means of access to the convention center, limiting the points of access is what I should say, and also having hand sanitizer everywhere, doing physical distancing, deep cleaning after meetings, all that sort of stuff. But in the end, the city said that it wasn't enough, and they canceled the contract. And so now they do have a plan to have their convention online. The Texas Democratic Party, a few weeks ago, held their convention online. I'm using the word convention very loosely, Arnie. Having a convention online is kind of bizarre. It was more like a telethon. You know, it was like a YouTube telethon. You know, with it. And the political parties in Texas are giant. You know, as we've talked about here, it's, as the chairman said, it's the big kahuna. You know, the Republican Party of Texas convention is a giant event. The only political convention on earth that's larger is the Communist Party of China. And so when we hear about, you know, at least 10,000 people coming to an event during a pandemic, this is bad news. Now, I had listened to the State Republican Executive Committee's deliberations about whether to go forward with an in-person convention last week. I believe this is after we talked. Everything's running together on me. I think it was on Thursday night where they had talked about whether to take the convention online voluntarily rather than the way it's happening now with the city canceling the in-person convention. You know, there's a lot of reason breaking out in the Republican Party.
The
representatives from the Lubbock area, which is very conservative, deep red West Texas, Lubbock area, said that when they polled the delegates from Lubbock County and the surrounding area, it came back 60-40 that people did not want to have an in-person convention because of concern.
Wow, from Lubbock. Wow, you're right. Reason is breaking out.
Nueces County is Corpus Christi. That was basically the same result. They said that about half of their delegates would not attend, and that was reflected in my conversations with, you know, representatives from within the Republican Party from North Texas, South Texas, Houston area, everywhere in between. At least half of the people that had been designated as delegates for the convention had serious health concerns. And let's think about who the people are, Arnie, you know, in the Republican Party. It's folks who are generally not just 55 and up, but a lot are 65 and up. people who are in vulnerable populations. They don't want to be exposed to this disease, by being in an indoor setting in a giant convention center in Houston. You know, I was thinking about the fact that, and we talked about this a little bit last week, you had all those people leading up to the 2016 election who wouldn't say that they were going to vote for Donald Trump. There are a lot of these Republicans now who are saying that they're not afraid of the coronavirus and that they don't agree with government intervention in the pandemic response and trying to get people to act certain ways and people being forced to wear masks and all this stuff. But those same people are afraid to go gather together and protest it together. And in the meantime, you had the Montgomery County judge, Mark Keogh. And of course, in Texas, just a reminder for the listeners, in the Northeast and elsewhere, the county judge is basically the executive for the county. The county judge in Montgomery County is a very conservative Tea Party style Republican. After Houston canceled the Republican Party convention in H-Town, the Montgomery County judge, which is just north of Harris County, it's the next one up, it's suburban Houston, he said, well, they could come hold it in our county. He would offer the Woodlands as the place that they could do this thing. And I don't think that people in the Woodlands want to see that happen either. Although, of the suburban counties in Texas, Montgomery County is the biggest Republican one left. We've talked many times about the fact that the suburbs are changing in Texas. Places like Fort Bend County, Collin County, Denton County, where Beto O'Rourke did very well in 2018, not in Montgomery County. In Montgomery County, they still vote about 80-20 Republican. And so we'll see if that catches any. See if that gets any traction, but I really doubt it. At this point, I think that they're going to have an online convention and just go on down the road. The only thing that the Republican Party in Texas has to do, and the Democrats already did their version of this, the Republicans have to choose their delegates for the national convention, and they have to pick their electors for president. And they can accomplish that online. One other thing that I thought was very interesting, Arnie, and this is reflective of what we see in Texas politics and in national politics too, Republicans at their convention love to do political combat with each other, right? They love to fight each other. They want to argue about immigration. They want to argue about legal pot. They want to argue about toll roads. You name the issue. They want to fight with each other. And so when the Republican Party chairman was laying out how this would be done online, he said they were going to use a company called Meeting Pulse, which I hadn't heard of before, but it's one of these platforms for having online meetings. He said that having a meeting of thousands of people, maybe 7,000 people online, he said that's a pretty niche market. And so this was the platform that he had settled on for them to use. It looks like that is the one they're going to use. The concern from the Republican Executive Committee members was whether or not they'd be able to have a spirited debate on that online platform, right, and have it in real time. And the chairman did say something interesting, which I think he would agree with. I think it's just a logistical thing. He was saying that, when political parties, when they gather amongst themselves and they argue about their platform, they have these spirited discussions. If you take it online, you are limiting the rights of the members because they can't do the same things that they would do in person, right? You can't jump up and interrupt the other person who's talking like you would in a meeting.
You're shrinking the parameters of the event.
You're doing interrupting motion as you would do Robert's Rules of Order and all of that. And so having it online will definitely be a different kind of convention. And we'll see if they're able to pull it off in the same way that the Democrats did. I would say the Democrats' version of this was more like a telethon, as I mentioned, where they had, YouTube speeches that they played for their members who were watching, people, the luminaries of the Democratic Party, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, people like that, addressed the Texas Democrats in their online convention. And between speeches and between panel discussions, it looked like, dialing for dollars, just send us your money if you want to beat the Republicans in the fall. And the Democrats here were able to raise $2 million for the party, which is more than the party raised in the entire 2016.
So let me just say something. Why? Can I tell you why?
They're calling that a success. We'll see.
Well, the reason
we'll see how the Republicans do. Mm-hmm.
When you go to a convention, you have your travel cost, you have your food cost, you have your hotel cost, you have your buying the tchotchke cost. If you're suddenly doing it online, you can then channel all those dollars into the party. So it's not like you're not spending the money, but now instead of spending it in a sort of more diverse and diffused way with the economy, you can now focus those dollars. And that, in part, I think explains what happens with the Democrats. But let me just say one other thing, is that this is perfect for the GOP. They get the Democratic mayor of Houston giving them cover as to why they're going to be forced online.
Right.
But what the Democratic mayor of Houston is reading is what the numbers are coming out of Tulsa after the sort of whatever that rally was, with only 6,000 as opposed to the 100,000.
The mega rally in Tulsa.
But they've seen a significant spike in the number of COVID positive cases in Tulsa. And someone said to me, but Arnie, don't forget, Juneteenth was the day before. And they had lots of rallies going on with the African-American community and Black Lives Matter. And then the next day you had Donald Trump's event. So here's what I did. I did sort of a split screen, and then I had the Tulsa event. I only could count three masks. Three. Okay. Right. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. looking. And then
lots
I had the split
the screen. Mm-hmm.
Right. And the June 19th, guess what? Everybody was masked up. You could find maybe mm-hmm. a handful of people that were masked up. And I said, well, if there was a likelihood for spread, I don't think it was A. I think it was B. So again, yeah. all these things are sort of giving cover to the Republican Party in Texas.
Yeah, when the Republican Montgomery County judge suggested having the alternate site, in his community for the convention, he said that there was, in his words, there was no objection in the city of Houston when they had 60,000 people on the streets at one point, a protest in the wake of the death of George Floyd. But as you said, there was a different attitude about mask wearing. And that yeah. aside, the science tells yeah. us we know there's a difference between outdoor gatherings and indoor gatherings. So that's a difference. You look at the spiking numbers of cases of COVID-19 in Texas, Arnie, and it really is disturbing on multiple levels. And the governor is already playing the blame game, which we can talk about. But just in the last 24 hours, Texas reported its worst day from COVID-19 since the pandemic began. 98 people died from the virus. A new record of 9,600 people got sick that are hospitalized now, which is the worst hospitalization number that we've seen in Texas. The governor has talked about this idea that the protests were happening and that Memorial Day weekend was, in his estimation, worse than July 4th because Memorial Day, people were not doing the things they needed to do as far as socially distancing, wearing masks and all that. Mm-hmm. In the governor's estimation, just looking at the intel that he's gotten from around the state for July 4th, Texans behaved better, as he put it, for July 4th. But let's get real here. There were lots of people protesting, but the numbers of people protesting, let's slow this part down. Those numbers are a drop in the bucket compared to the fact that over the last month and a half, going back to April 27th, the governor opened the state.
I know.
He opened everything in the state, all businesses across the state. By the time Memorial Day was happening, businesses, like restaurants, were open at 50%, 75%, depending on where they were. A lot of people who work in offices were going back to their offices. Some people still working at home. One of the things I wanted to share with your listeners, Arnie, that I've seen, reflected in news reports and in the way that the pandemic has played out in Texas, and I think this is probably different in every state because every population has dealt with different orders from their governors and from their local officials. When Texans have been asked to do something during this pandemic, they've done it. When the governor asked people to stay home, people did that. When the governor has now asked people to wear masks, we see the attitudes reflected in polls that people are willing to do that. And it was a matter of being asked, and asked with a unified voice, rather than the governor fighting with local officials about the way that these things were supposed to play out. We'll go back to the beginning of the pandemic. It was the county judge and the mayor in Austin that shut down South by Southwest. A big economic decision at the time. Some people probably thought it was an overreaction. In hindsight, it looks pretty good. In Houston, they shut down Rodeo Houston, which attracts tens of thousands of people. They just this week decided that for this fall, they're not going to have the State Fair of Texas. You have these decisions being made at the local level. When the governor said it's time to go back to work, people did that. Texans are willing to step up, and I think about past disasters. I think about the fact that in Houston and Harris County and all along the Gulf Coast and what we call the Coastal Bend down to Corpus Christi, when there have been hurricanes in the past, you would see long lines of people in Houston, and the caption would say, these are not people who are waiting for food. These are not people who are waiting for water. These are people lined up to volunteer to help. And I remember in 2005, when all of those evacuees were brought from the Superdome in Louisiana in New Orleans to the Astrodome in Houston, there were lines of cars lined up for miles at the Astrodome. It was Texans dropping off food
right.
because they're there to help. I think it's not reflected in national coverage of Texas politics for sure, because we have some very divisive leadership, people like the little governor, Dan Patrick.
Yeah.
But just average Texans want to help. I think it's what Jim Hightower and others talked about as sort of prairie populism. Laura Bush talked about this when she was, before she was first lady, when George W. Bush, and she lived in Midland for many years. Out in West Texas, there's this sort of populism of, if your neighbor needs help, you do that. And you don't ask the question.
So,
And so there is a sense of being a community here, and what the state needs instead of what it's getting is clear leadership. Just ask us, tell us what we need to do. Anytime a Texan shows up, you show up at somebody else's barbecue, the first thing you ask is, what can I help with? That's the attitude that people have around here. And there's a way to harness that that's helpful. But what did we get instead? We got a governor who was dithering, the same as the president dithered on this thing. If you go back and you look at the fact that the president didn't act quickly and our state leadership in Texas did not act quickly, you know, to try to contain this virus, it leads us to where we are. And you think about the kinds of sacrifices that people have made. People did stay home for, you know, a month, 6 weeks or whatever. They did what they were asked. People did socially distance. People did put on the masks when they were asked to do that in their local communities. For the most part, there's some protesters. There's always going to be that. But when it comes to trying to get an entire population of people to, you know, to do something, this is when leadership is so, so critical. If you had the president all the way down to every elected official, down to dog catcher, if they were all saying the same thing, it would still be hard to get people to put on a mask, right? That would still be difficult. Right. But if everybody pulls in the same direction, we can get something like this done. And it really is a disservice and a disrespect to the Texans and Americans who did what they were asked and sacrificed. And a lot of people who had to go to a food bank for the first time ever because they couldn't go to work. And in the meantime, leadership didn't do what they needed to do to contain this virus, which they have figured out in other countries. It's not like this can't be done, but we certainly haven't done it here.
Well, what you see is confusion. And confusion just basically reinforces distrust. And that's what's happening. You're hearing something from the health officials. You're hearing something from your mayor. You're hearing something from your governor. You're hearing something from your lieutenant governor. I mean, nobody is working off the same page. And I just want to let you know that as we're on the air, the Supreme Court basically said that I think New York could actually get those subpoena the information about Donald Trump's tax returns.
People probably don't know that we're recording on.
I had to look because I got like 14.
And so I could see like this little dance breakout in Arnie's box on the Zoom. All of a sudden she started like break dancing while I was talking and I didn't know what was going on. I didn't think I had said anything that interesting.
No, anything that needed to be celebrated. You said the beautiful things. You talked about the fact that there is a community in Texas, that there is Velcro, that people are willing to sort of have each other's back. The problem is that when you're working the divide and we're adding to the confusion, then people aren't given the direction they need to figure out what it even means to have your back. I mean, let's be honest here. And let me just say one more thing before I let you go. And that is, I'm seeing parallels between Houston and New York. Since we followed a lot of, obviously, what was happening in New York City when it was the epicenter. Now I feel to some extent Houston is now the epicenter of COVID-19. And what we're seeing is a number of deaths of people at home. They never got to the hospital. They're seeing a huge spike. So the number of deaths from COVID-19 may not be reflected by what's happening at your hospitals. It may be reflected by what happens at home. And here's the question I want to ask you. Mm-hmm. You've told me over and over again, there are 600,000 undocumented immigrants in Houston, Texas. I suspect that number is equal in the city of New York, if not more than that. They have a real concern. They get sick too, but they don't have access to Medicare. They don't have access to Medicaid. They don't have health insurance. They're afraid of sort of coming out of the shadows. And I'm wondering, as we're looking at this huge spike in deaths at home, whether there's a connection between the undocumented community that really fears the healthcare system, even though they may need the healthcare system, and what is happening. So I just thought I would throw that out.
There's no definitive numbers on that, Arnie. It's easy to understand why. People who are not documented often are treated at our county facilities. In Houston, for example, the big county hospital is Ben Taub Hospital. And it's not uncommon, for example, if an undocumented immigrant is doing roofing work. And let's say they're in the middle of the hot Texas summer and they're up there working on a roof on a house, that they would fall and hurt themselves. And the person they're working for will put them in the back of a pickup truck and take them down to Ben Taub and just drop them on the sidewalk in front of the hospital and take off. Happens often. That part of it is a cost to the local taxpayer because that's paid for through property taxes through the county hospital district. But as far as trying to track, and my point is that those folks might be taken there by somebody who knows that they need care. But if they start to get sick, they're probably just going to suffer in silence at home. It's always so ironic to hear some of these folks bemoaning the idea, like Donald Trump will talk about this. There were so many illegal immigrants who voted in the election, and there's no evidence for that, of course. And Democrats would then joke that they can't even get legal Latinos to go vote in Texas. And so the bottom line is that you have a huge population that is very afraid to interact with anybody that they perceive to be in authority because they think those people are going to report them to the people who can send them out of the country. what you have is not families of undocumented people. You have families of people who are of mixed documentation.
Mixed status, exactly.
It's very common in Texas and other places, more common in Texas and California, to have, you know, people who are legally in the country, somebody in their house, you know, somebody who lives with them is not documented. And so a lot of those people who are documented are also afraid to themselves interact with anybody they perceive as being in authority. That's why these people don't vote. They don't go to the, they don't even, and I'm talking about legal people, you know, people who
they don't want to expose the rest of their family.
I want to be clear about that. Some people who are citizens won't vote because they don't want to interact with anybody that they see as being an authority, because it could end up triggering some event that, you know, they find out that their grandma or their aunt or whatever is not documented, then they get kicked out of the country.
And that's the fear of the census, that the census won't be able to accurately reflect the numbers of people that live in Texas because of exactly what you said. They're just so afraid. So last but not least, just clarify something, since there's only been confusion. Is there a mandatory mask order coming out of the governor's office? Yes or no, and who does it apply to? I feel like I'm looking at a moving target. I just want to know, on Thursday morning when we Zoom this, July 9th, what is Governor Abbott saying today?
After we talked last week, Arnie, the governor did a complete 180 on this. Until last Thursday, he had insisted that the government should never be able to force Texans to put on a face covering. He had said over and over again that he encouraged people to wear masks, but he never would mandate it. That was his promise. Then on Thursday, he put out a YouTube video where he said the exact opposite. He was ordering the vast majority of Texans to wear a mask. He said that if you are in public in a county that has more than 20 positive COVID-19, that would be the vast majority of Texans, but not the vast majority of counties, by the way. Most people live in the urban centers in Texas. People in Houston, Dallas, Austin, for example, have to wear a mask if they're out in public, and they could face a fine not to exceed $250 if they're not wearing the mask. So he's going the other direction on this now, but he is suffering the blowback within the Republican Party. There have been several county GOP executive committees that have now voted just since last Thursday to censure the governor over doing that. They say it's a violation of liberty.
Of liberty and great journalism. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, known as the Voice of Texas. Thank you. I can't wait till next Thursday when we Zoom, because I'm sure it is a moving target and we'll see what's happening by then. Please stay healthy and take care of Texas for us. Thank you.
Talk soon, Arnie.
All right, ciao. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. We will be right back. Of course, don't forget, great producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins.
When it comes to runoff, less is more on this current cast. Too much rain and too many people using a lot of water can overwhelm aging stormwater systems. That can cause them to overflow and dump pollution into rivers. Instead of rebuilding systems or adding bigger pipes, many cities are turning to green infrastructure to meet clean water standards. By creating green space where plants and soils can capture rainwater and runoff,
less is being sent through the pipes and there's a less chance for overflows.
That's Katie Rousseau of the nonprofit American Rivers. She says rain gardens, storage ponds, and permeable pavement, which treat stormwater at its source, are a real solution and cost less than fixing old systems. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
As long as you got so much to lay, well, it's all right. somewhere down the road when somebody plays
at the end of the line,
the purple haze.
Well, it's all right, even when push comes to shove. Well, it's all right, if you got someone to love. Well, it's all right, everything will work out fine. Well, it's all right, we're going to the end of the line.
Don't have to be ashamed of the car I drive. I'm just glad to be here, happy to feel that.
At the end of the line, of the line.
And it don't matter if you're by my side.
At the end of the line,
I'm satisfied.
Well, it's all.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, I want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Thursday morning, so some of the information that we're going to be talking about is going to be somewhat dated, or it's going to be coming literally off the transom as we talk, because the Supreme Court is weighing in on many decisions. He joins us every other week. His name is Bill Curry, a former advisor to Bill Clinton, a fabulous progressive talker, ran for the governor of Connecticut twice, has written for Salon.com and many other places, and we value his voice, and he has probably the biggest following on The Attitude. So I'm just grateful that you show up, Bill Curry.
And as
you were showing up, I was going, oh my God, what's going on with the Supreme Court? The decisions are coming down. And luckily you had more time, since I was in the middle of an interview, to sort of begin to sort of evaluate what those decisions were. And of course you haven't been able to sort of dig in deep, but let's sort of talk a little bit about them, because they really have political consequences as much as we're trying to understand what the Supreme Court did. It was pretty obvious what they were doing. At the same time, it has, I think, enormous political opportunity.
Well, first of all, you know, what are the stakes? We know this about Donald Trump, even though it hasn't been proved in a court of law. The Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigations proved it on many fronts. What we know publicly about his business dealings makes it by far the simplest explanation of his career. Donald Trump's entire life has been one extended criminal enterprise. I have no doubt whatsoever that if all the public documents were made available, if all of his documents were made public, he would be found to have committed hundreds and hundreds of felonies, not just a couple, but, you know, hundreds. And in fact, I have little doubt thousands. And so these questions of whether anybody can ever get a hold of any of his records, how hard he's fought to protect everything from his high school and college transcripts to his tax returns and business records, it's been a fight at the center of his life. The two decisions today are mixed, and they don't tell us whether we're ever going to see this information before we get to vote on Trump. First decision says that the prosecutor in New York can see what he wants to, because it's a valid exercise of the legal authority of New York. There's no doubt that there's a criminal question here. This was centered on the Michael Cohen payments, Trump's role as an unindicted co-conspirator in those crimes for which Cohen went to jail. Remember that Trump is the person who directed the crimes. Therefore, whatever sentence Michael Cohen got, Trump would normally get a longer sentence. Cohen was just following orders. On the congressional side, with many Democrats joining in the decision, the court said the Congress doesn't have the right to private information about Trump without a solid showing of the need in to at least one of the justices without, in fact, an impeachment in process. Oh. They were sort of clear that if you weren't impeaching him, You couldn't get his private information. I will just concede that the question of obtaining private information is a thornier question. Pretending that Trump's corruption isn't a big enough question to justify the exercise of that subpoena is just, to me, denial. And if you don't mind my adding one other thing to this, this whole recent string of cases in the Supreme Court regarding the rights of Congress to oversight of the executive branch, the idea that to some justices, this is a political question and therefore one that has to be decided between the branches. The justices say that Congress has the power of the purse and therefore has other tools that Congress can also compel evidence through physical force, through its own inherent arrest powers. But all that is very, very sketchy. None of that's been ever used effectively. And the only thing I'll say about it is that it brings us back to all these Senate races. And the only way I believe that the Congress in a case like this ever has real oversight authority, given the ideological and partisan corruption of the judicial branch of government in our time, is for one party to have both houses. That makes the power of the purse argument of the court conservatives
valid,
more real. And so just for everybody thinking about Senate races, you know, an entire legislative agenda, which is even from a centrist Democrat, vastly different from what the country is now, vastly better. It is also impossible, should Trump ever be reelected, to have any meaningful checks and balances. Checks and balances, the one phrase about the Constitution that everybody knows, that goes to the very heart of its architecture by James Madison. That fundamental concept has been thrown overboard by the system that we have, and the only way to get it back is to elect a Democratic Senate.
Right. No, exactly. I just want to remind everyone a little bit about what happened. So we do have the split decision, the decision where they said that Trump is not immune from the New York subpoena. Let me just pull something from CNN just to sort of make sure that we have this fully fleshed out. New York District Attorney Cyrus Vance had served a subpoena on Trump's longtime accounting firm, Mazars USA, for his tax returns as part of an investigation into hush money payments to two women with whom the president allegedly had extramarital affairs, pursuant to testimony of Michael Cohen. Now, what happened in oral arguments was that Trump's attorney basically said that there was a temporary presidential immunity against the prosecutor's subpoena. And you mentioned that some of this will not be coming out in a timely fashion in time for November. So I'm just trying to figure out why. They know what they want. They know where they can find it. They already know where the accounting firm is. Is it that it won't come out of the New York court system, so it won't be made public? It'll only be like privileged information that will be given to the grand jury? I'm just trying to figure out, why won't we have access to it? What's
okay.
going to stop?
So here's what happens. Let me point out a couple things about that decision that I was able to read through in the 5 minutes we had it before going to the show. Yeah. And that is, first of all, it is overruling. I don't know if they said this explicitly, but we got our first court ruling ever on whether a president is actually liable to criminal prosecution while in office just a few months ago. 200 odd years into our republic. Previously, it had only been two opinions from the Justice Department written by employees of impeached presidents Nixon and Clinton that said a president couldn't be. And that was taken by Robert Mueller, among others, as the law. And a federal district court judge said, that's preposterous. There is nothing in our Constitution that says that. And that is correct, in my view, but it is no longer correct legally, since in this position opinion today, that decision of a federal district court in New York was effectively overruled. When this information goes to Cyrus Vance, it's privileged information. It's supposed to be, you know, not be leaked.
That was my question.
We all know it's not supposed to be leaked. But there are many ways in which it could be leaked. I'm not quite as pessimistic as this very first round of punditry would indicate. I'm worried, but I'm not quite as worried. For instance, a judge can rule that a grand jury can release the information under certain circumstances. It hasn't been explored, but it's possible. More likely, Vance can simply accelerate the process. Depending on how much he knows now, what his resources are, and how clear the record is, he can issue subpoenas. He can issue a statement of the case that would be brought or will be brought if Trump leaves. And in those documents, he can include information from Trump's tax and business records.
That's right.
So,
we know I've...
So that's, if we see this before we vote, we should need to, like everything else, you know, we shouldn't pretend to know things we don't know in this life, but we should also not pretend to that we don't know things that really deep down we do know. Trump's corruption doesn't need another expose, but it would be great if we had one. It would help. And I would say that, today's ruling in this split decision of the Supreme Court, the ruling that the information goes to Cy Vance in New York means that there is a decent shot, if not quite a likelihood, that some of this will see the light of day before we vote.
Well, you know, I just was thinking about this. It really does feel like the wheels are coming off between Mary Trump getting her book. I mean, first we have Bolton. They tried to stop that. Then we have Mary Trump. They tried to stop that. Now we've got this decision from the Supreme Court. I mean, he has been so good at sealing himself off, creating this moat around him where, you know, only he's privileged to lie and be corrupt and nobody else is because he's done that. And I feel like they're draining the moat. That's what this feels like as we're looking at what's going through. And then on top of all this happening, just yesterday, we find out that Colonel Vindman was not going to be given his colonelship, that Donald Trump has weighed in, is going to become a full colonel, that there has been just this hostile environment. No surprise. We knew it was hostile the minute he was walked out of the White House in February of 2019. But that he has decided to retire. And in an interesting way, the timing of his retirement also brings us back to, you know, his testimony, to what he said. Of course, my audience knows it because they hear it every single day because it's how I begin my show and it's how I've begun my show for the last 4 months with the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. But again, it sort of gives you a split screen. This is what a patriot sounds like. This is what your president sounds like. I mean, it's almost like if you want to know what a traitor looks and sounds like, I think you elected one.
You know, I couldn't agree more. The whole tableau of witnesses in those hearings was such a testimony to the quality of public servants in this country.
Exactly. Oh my God.
To the role they played. Those witnesses offered more accountability than Robert Mueller and the Congress combined. And they at least left us a record of what really happened and what it meant. And so hats off to them. And they all, unlike Mueller and the Congress, they all risked their careers and their livelihoods and even their personal safety in order to do that. And so, you know, I salute every one of them. And so, Vindman was fabulous.
Right. But, so let me just say something. So let me just say about the impeachment hearings and what you just said about all the people that took the risk, that spoke the truth, that were not that did what was right, as Colonel Vindman used over and over again. And that is that I talk to a lot of young people all the time because I live with law students. I hang out with people much younger than me. And a lot of them are saying for the first time ever, maybe I should go to the Fletcher School at Tufts. Maybe I should go. When they saw those people do something, because I think they had the same sort of concern about whether you really wanted to serve in the government, whether you wanted to be quote unquote part of the bureaucracy. And then they saw the courage and the intellect and the power and the understanding and the knowledge of the world. And they didn't want to be on the sidelines of that. They wanted to be that. So they actually did a service to the nation. Even though they may have put themselves at risk, they were a great education.
What a wonderful thing. You should tell them that. You should contact the witnesses and let them know that it reminds people our age of the effect that Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein had on people's interest in journalism.
And that
they accomplished that much. And of course, contrast it to what we see of Trump. You know, one of the things about Trump is that we don't see him as much. And it's extraordinary to me. I may have mentioned last year, a couple of weeks ago, someone close to me said, isn't it interesting that Trump is tweeting less these days? I said, actually, what's interesting is that he's tweeting more, not less, but that you're not hearing it as much. And it reflects Trump's complete confusion, inability to land a punch. The debate has moved so far past him. The culture has left him so far behind that, you know, that as Joe Biden's starting to go outdoors, Donald Trump's starting to stay home. And that the single public personality, probably in American history, but certainly in our lives, who has been able to intrude the most on our consciousness from day to day is now Cheshire Catting. He's now not yet, and I don't think anything's in the bag here, and we all have to give this election from this day to election day all of our attention. You can just see how Trump is completely at sea with what to do. In Tulsa, and at Rushmore. But one of the things that was clear is that Trump has realized that he has to code his racist message more cleverly. And that means that it's more abstract and ambiguous when you get it. And you could see from the faces in the audience members in Tulsa and Rushmore that some of them, it was so cleverly coded, they were no longer getting it. And the Times and the Post got it when they told about it, but that it's lost a lot of its oomph. He can't be specifically racial. In the Rushmore speech, he referenced more African Americans, I would wager, than he has in his entire life previous to the Rushmore speech. The Tuskegee Airmen and Martin Luther King and Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong and Muhammad Ali.
Very good. Write that piece. That's hilarious. You know,
and he had to do that in order to provide further cover for the fundamentally reactionary message he was delivering. It really, at the end, it was a less punchy speech about culture wars. And among the many ways in which this is mistimed, I truly believe the country is turning a corner on race. I know the proof will be in the pudding, but I think it's sort of happening. But we may also have turned a corner because of George Floyd and COVID and so many things we're learning about the injustice of our own economy.
Oh.
People realize, more people at least each day realize, that they cannot treat politics as a cheap, venomous burlesque. That it can't just be this this constant, vicious distraction, that they have to get problems solved. You have to do something real. And at that point, Trump's entire act becomes irrelevant.
You know, it's interesting.
The only thing he's ever done for his supporters, other than his wealthy supporters, is to provide them catharsis and distraction and denial in the midst of their own imploding lives. I think that so many things have changed here in the favor of the Democratic Party in this election, but more importantly, in the favor of progress. You know, you and I know that every time we ever ran for office, we told some group of people somewhere that this could be the most important election of their lives.
I know.
I never added the subtext, you know, because I'm running, okay?
Yeah, but, that's right.
You know, but I honestly sit watching this and think there's never been a clearer choice. There's never been two roads that were so divergent as the road between Trump and Biden and the Democratic Party. So and what's happening here is just extraordinary. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Don't be sorry. I'm listening to you. And so this morning I woke up and I was thinking about, you know, the order coming down from ICE about foreign students at universities.
Unbelievable.
And the choice of unbelievable. And then I heard the order that Donald Trump and Betsy DeVos were talking about schools being open. And then, you know, Donald Trump is showing up in my state on Saturday and he's bringing his, you know, COVID spreading event to my state that's trying so desperately not to, you know, get COVID. I mean, there wasn't every day. It's like he almost has a checklist. How can I be a bigger, pardon my language. I tweeted this out. I wrote, Trump's especially odious actions in the last few weeks is a wet dream for every racist and anti-intellectual in America. And it really is when it comes to his attack on schools. This is an attack on public education. What Betsy DeVos and Donald Trump want to do is they want to destroy public education. They don't want you to go back to school. They want to literally dismantle public education because they're asking people to make a life and death choice. What they're doing with the college campuses by saying you can't decide whether you should be online or in class education is, you know, basically saying we're going to send these people home if you decide at least temporarily to go online. What does that do? That takes away the diversity within the educational institution, and it takes away the vital dollars. You know that, Bill. How many of these foreign students are paying full freight and keeping so many of these doors open at these higher universities, including public universities? So in a lot of ways, it's an anti-intellectual thing as well as a racist thing, whether it's public education or universities or what he's doing with Black Lives Matter and the defund the police. I'm exhausted by him because I just think, who's thinking this stuff up? You couldn't imagine being so almost nefarious.
No question about it. You know what? First of all, America, in part because of its financial corruption, in part because of its divided government, it has never looked more like a failed state. All of these, whether it's getting out of the WHO or threatening the budgets of local public education or threatening the financial viability of higher education. All of this in order to have scapegoats and start wars. And nothing to do with policy. Nothing to do with, all of this is about feeding his fascist base. And that, of course, you know, in itself is a series of impeachable offenses. I was thinking this morning that, you know, Trump is becoming like Jim Jones, okay? You know, yeah. he's turning red state America into Jonestown. Telling people don't wear your masks, don't socially distance, everybody back to school, everybody back to the bars. All of this is a hoax. And it really, this is Jim Jones. Somebody getting up and letting all of his own followers die in order to gratify his own ego, and in this case, his own political interest. And I can't help but think, again, that as people look at their now imploding economy and the resurgent COVID virus and everything that the George Floyd tape and so many others finally focused us on, that people know that we need someone to actually lead. And we need someone to lead. And increasingly, they know that it's not Trump. He'll get at least 40% of the vote. He'll get 40% of the vote. But if Biden gets to 53 or 54%, that's the modern version of a landslide. It could be an electoral college landslide. It would bring us the Senate. And the Republican Party would finally begin doing what we thought they were doing in 2012, which is reexamining itself and beginning to fight over its first premises. There could be a Republican civil war that goes on for a decade or longer. This truly could be a year like 1856 or 1932 or 1980, in which a major political party founders. The future of our country, which with 4.5 million young people turning 18 every year, with minority populations growing in their numbers, this is the last chance for a racist, homophobic, xenophobic party to win a national election. And enough Republicans are beginning to see that even now, that the chance of winning this one is slipping away from them. And that if they wake up the next morning, this Republican Party will have to have the kind of fight that could end up in its undoing. Mitt Romney belongs more in my party than in Trump's. And in fact, there are a lot of Mitt Romneys in my party. I wish there weren't so many, but there are. Yeah. But he belongs more in my party than Trump's. And there are a whole set of, you know, suburban educated Republicans and others who won't be able to go along, and the base won't tolerate a moderate. We're on the eve. If we win this election, we may well win five more after it. You know, there are no final victories, as Larry O'Brien once reminded us in politics, but there are some long lasting victories. This one could be one of those. The political landscape of this country, like the cultural landscape, could be about to change in a more fundamental way than any of us alive have ever seen.
Well, you know, when you're beginning to see the number of U.S. senators that say they won't go to Florida for the Republican convention, and they have attended every Republican convention since they were in utero, and when you begin to see what just happened in Texas, where, you know, the Houston mayor basically said, you can't have the largest convention on the planet except for communist China, which is the Texas GOP convention in Houston. And for the most part, he's giving cover to the GOP that doesn't even want to have the damn convention live. I mean, you're beginning to look in an interesting way. The Republicans need the Democrats to give them cover. The Republicans need the Democrats to sort of blame them if schools don't open, because they know if schools open, the economy tanks. You know, I mean, in a lot of ways, they now have to hide behind the Democrats' actions because it's the only thing that will save them. That will save them. That's the irony. You know, they're going to blame them even as they need them desperately to take the actions and exhibit the leadership that they are so terrified of being able to show because of what Donald Trump is doing. It's going to be such an interesting election. And at the same time, what I'm trying to figure out is does Biden fill the moment? Or does Biden understand that the moment will not be filled by him, but that if he brings together a team, because we're seeing Bernie and Joe beginning to work together, offer sort of policy solutions together. Is that real or Memrex? Is that just something that's going to happen between now and then November? Once Joe wins, it's au revoir. I never looked at those policy papers again. I'm just so terrified because I think so much change is demanded.
Well, first of all, Biden at least understands the need to conciliate the left on the level of message. And that in itself is something that Hillary Clinton never understood. Right. So that's good news. Secondly, I think it is his nature, and he will discover when he's in office that the Republican Party changes that I've just talked about, they won't have happened for a while, and that the only people he can negotiate with are his own base. Right. The entire discussion in this country, if we win this election, that 40% or the three quarters of it that are truly hardcore, they won't really be part of the political discussion. The entire useful political discussion of this country will go on as it has for some years within the Democratic Party, except that if we have the White House, the Senate, and the Congress, it'll have meaning.
Bill Curry, thank you so much for joining us. Bill Curry joins us every other Friday, because I know we Zoom on Thursday, and I'm so grateful for your voice and the timeliness of your quick read on the Supreme Court decision that came in literally
I did the best
as we're
I
going
have.
On the air. That's right. All right, ciao.
Thanks, Arnie, as always.
All right, bye-bye.
See you.
All right, everyone, this is The Attitude with Arnie Artis, with producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. Wish me this next week. You there?